This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. At 2 p.m. today, if you're watching a city council vote closely enough, you'll see who's got the power in this city. That's according to the political editor for Seattle Met magazine, Josh Feit. First, the voting part. The Seattle City Council is expected to unanimously pass an ordinance this afternoon on secure scheduling laws. It would mostly affect the way retail and food service employers schedule their workers. Employers will have to give 2 weeks advance notice of schedules. There'll be penalties for last-minute shift changes. And employers can't schedule workers to close on one night and open the next morning. Now, for the power part, Josh Feit says this vote is evidence that the Chamber of Commerce is dying in Seattle and the power that used to lie with business owners is going somewhere else.
Not only is the Chamber losing its pull in town, political pull in town, we've seen that over several elections now. What you're really seeing is an ascension or ascendance of labor kind of taking control of the dialogue at City Hall.
Taking control, how so?
Well, I think what you're seeing this year, right? I mean, after the 15, which was kind of a long task force discussion.
$15 minimum wage.
$15 minimum wage, kind of the last big labor victory in Seattle. Now, you know, with very little friction, you have the mayor and traditionally some of his adversaries on the left, namely Councilmember Lisa Herbold, Councilmember Shama Sawant, you know, running with this labor-backed ordinance, and the mayor, he proposed it too. It's a kumbaya. It's going to go through unanimously today. So that's what I mean when you have something that so has such an impact and such a role in the day-to-day ability of companies to manage their business, just sailing right through the mayor and the council.
Would local unions call themselves powerful compared to business, or would they say they're finally getting a few scraps?
You know, you'd have to ask them. I'm not saying what they're getting is here is bad. This seems like a pretty good law, or it seems like a good law, giving 2 weeks advance note and getting predictability pay. You don't have to do clopenings, as they're called. But I think at some level, you have to start questioning the integrity of laws that are being written by labor, right? And
what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, this law clearly comes to us from labor, and they've been organizing on the ground for this for a while. Again, I think there's some really good things in this law as I just walked through. But why a labor exemption? You know, that has to raise some spider senses for people.
Are you saying, Josh, that if a company is a union shop, then this new secure scheduling law won't apply to that company?
There is an exemption, and essentially the issue for unions, the issue is left to the bargaining table. Now, there is language in the legislation that says that you have to meet the standard of the legislation. So there is that protection. But again, you have to be a little nervous when those kinds of issues are left to the back and forth between the union and the company, and will there be discrepancies? And it's left up to a little chance there.
What are you looking for at the vote this afternoon?
It's not so much what I'm looking for, it's what I'm seeing. And what I see here is a town that is really doing labor's bidding.
How powerful is labor now? How should we think about the scope of influence that labor has in Seattle now?
I mean, I want to start by saying, Bill, that workers' rights are real issues, serious issues, and it's good that labor has a voice in this town and is able to move its agenda. I think where my spider senses go up is when you look at the specific law, you have to wonder about the integrity of a law that labor's pushing where labor is exempt. What that tells me is there's an agenda here behind these laws, which might be unions are trying to pass laws to make it better for companies to unionize. Now, is that necessarily bad? You know, issue to issue, but it's something that we should be nervous about.
Why are you surprised that the mayor and the council are unified on this?
Well, if you look at other issues, there is kind of a left-right divide in some ways. And really, you know, the mayor kind of ran as an establishment candidate. And I think, you know, he's running the risk after 15 and now this of alienating business a little. So it's surprising from that standpoint. It's also surprising because we've seen kind of progressive pushback right now on homelessness, right? So the council's kind of carved out a progressive position, people like Mike O'Brien, people like Lisa Herbold versus the mayor. And so here you just see this big kumbaya over this issue. I think that's a little surprising.
And what does that unity tell you about where power lies in Seattle now?
On workers' rights, I think you see a real unified city. Now, that's not a bad thing, necessarily. Just generically, I have trouble when one kind of power broker or one player has so much influence. And, you know, we will see. I don't think the city necessarily is not in sync with the city, right? We have an initiative on the ballot right now that the city council sent to voters, again, via labor, for hotel workers' rights. And I think that'll probably pass with a pretty strong showing. So again, it's not necessarily that the mayor and the council are out of sync with voters on this.
So with the influence labor has now, what do you think is labor's next accomplishment in Seattle? What's coming up?
Bill, you know, I don't know what their specific agenda item is. You know, they've ticked off some real big wins in the last couple years with paid leave, with 15, and now a secured scheduling. So, you know, I think there's going to be a focus on women's issues, equal pay, and that kind of angle from labor.
Josh Feit is politics editor at Seattle Met and editor of their local politics blog, Publicola. The Seattle City Council will vote this afternoon on the secure scheduling law. We'll cover it here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. As you know, the polls show Trump and Clinton both unpopular. One of your alternatives was in Seattle this weekend. The Libertarian candidate, Gary Johnson, held a rally Saturday afternoon at the Sheraton. Before the rally, Johnson told KUOW's David Hyde what his message is for Washingtonians.
Well, it's the same message to Washingtonians as it is everywhere. I think that myself and Bill Weld, as the Libertarian nominees for president and vice president, speak on behalf of most Americans, being fiscally conservative, socially inclusive, skeptical when it comes to our military intervention, skeptical when it comes to our military supporting regime change. And then being a free trade, free market, believing that that will result in more U.S. jobs, not less U.S. jobs. So I think we distinguish ourselves in a number of categories that I think are reflective of about 60% of the electorate not currently represented with Clinton or Trump.
Let me get to some Seattle-specific issues, because I'm curious, I think listeners are probably curious, about what the Libertarian message is on, for example, homelessness. It's an issue everywhere. It's a big issue here in Seattle, has been for a while.
Well, that it is going to be a state's issue, that it is going to be a local issue. Looking at affordable housing, there's a great example of how Libertarian solutions would come to bear. If you had an availability of land and you disregarded all building codes, that isn't to say you wouldn't hire engineers and architects that were going to design incredibly efficient housing. You go to the IKEA exhibit and you see what 600 feet can be. You know, if you were to build that kind of structure from an affordable housing standpoint, disregarding zoning. I'm sure the city of Seattle has 20 acres somewhere that they could designate to potentially deal with homelessness. But an issue that Seattle's going to have to deal with.
But is it more a question of markets helping solve the problem, or does government need to get involved?
Well, in this case, you have government that spends money in these areas. Wouldn't it be nice to spend those monies on things that actually worked?
Another issue that's important here in Seattle, important all over the country, issues of policing, Black Lives Matter. What's the message from the Libertarian side?
Black lives do matter, and here's why. Blacks are being shot at the rate of six times that if you're white. If you're arrested on drug-related crime, there's a four times more likelihood that you'll go to prison than if you're white. If you're of color, there's that four times more likelihood. Look, you're pulled over and you are of color. There's a bigger chance that you're going to be harassed by police. Me, as a white person, if I were subject to the same harassment, I'd probably end up yelling and I'd probably end up handcuffed. But I'm not subject to that same kind of harassment. So we've had our heads in the sand over the discrimination that does exist in this country and is ongoing. I think it has roots in the drug war. And since 1999, there's been no politician in the United States that's been more outspoken regarding the war on drugs and the harm that it has done to all of us.
Do you think there's a role for the federal government, in this case the Department of Justice, stepping in and asking Seattle to step up and do a better job of policing?
I think that is the federal role, is through the Department of Justice. I mean, what are the common threads in communities where best practices exist, least discrimination exists? What are the common threads in communities where the most discrimination, the most violence exists? I think the Department of Justice can play a central role in disseminating that information and reducing what is ongoing discrimination and resulting in violence.
The environment's really important to people here in the Northwest. What's the libertarian message on the environment?
Well, the environment is important, period. We all care about the environment. And from a libertarian perspective, I support the Environmental Protection Agency. I think it comes under the fundamental role of government protecting us. I think that the majority of Americans are fiscally conservative. So smaller government, just smarter government, less taxes. That's money that you and I could be spending on our lives. That isn't to say there isn't a fundamental role when it comes to government. I think that fundamental role is protecting us against individuals, groups, corporations, foreign governments that would do us harm. And I put pollution in that category of harm. And but for the government, and I speak now having been governor of New Mexico and seen polluters in northern New Mexico that had been allowed to contaminate for decades, that because of the federal EPA, I was able to designate them as Superfund sites as governor.
Libertarian presidential candidate Gary Johnson talking with KUOW's David Hyde. On Saturday, Johnson held a rally for supporters here at the downtown Seattle Sheraton. Gary Johnson will not be on the presidential debate stage a week from tonight. His poll numbers are too low for him to qualify. So it's going to be Clinton and Trump and KUOW and you. Because KUOW's Ross Reynolds and Humanities Washington's Zeki Barak Hamid will be leading trivia games at Naked City Brewery in Greenwood. Monday evening, that's the 26th, starting at 5:30. You can find out more at kuow.org/engage. And in case you can't make it next Monday, we're going to do this for the next two presidential debates as well. We're sharing a link to more information with you on Twitter right now, at KUOW. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Gaze across the mountains of the Northwest these days, and you might notice an unusual number of dead trees, dead firs, pines, other conifers scattered among the green ones. Now, drought is usually considered the prime culprit, but research suggests the usual damage drought does is being compounded by climate change. From Jefferson Public Radio, Liam Moriarty reports from Oregon.
On a clear, sunny morning, I join Matt Krunglevich on the side of Mount Ashland. He points toward the hillside to the west.
The biggest key that you can see is these pockets of dead and dying trees, the red needles, and then some of the ones that were probably from 2 or 3 years ago that are gray now.
Krunglevich is with the Oregon Department of Forestry. He says that it's easy to miss, but once you start tuning your eye to notice the rust red and gray amidst the green, you notice those dead trees all over the place. So what's going on?
Basically, that's where the trees are starting to succumb to insects and pathogens. In the last several years, the combination of the drought, the longer summers, and maybe a couple of fires that we've had have caused the insect and disease populations to really start to increase, and we're starting to see the effects of that.
Krunglevich takes me further up Mount Ashland for a closer look at the dying trees. We scramble down a hillside to look at a few trees that have been cut down and left. Krunglevich takes out a hatchet and chips away at some of the dead tree's bark to reveal the insect damage underneath.
So what these insects go after is that cambium layer. So they drill through the bark and they get to the cambium layer.
So who are we looking at here then?
I think we're looking at turpentine beetles here. So this is a itty-bitty little guy. about the size, oh gosh, of a piece of pencil lead maybe. He's going to try to go out and eat some more trees.
What foresters call drought-related conifer mortality is reaching record levels throughout much of the Pacific Northwest. A 2009 study by researchers from the University of Washington, Oregon State University, and federal agencies found the rate of tree death in the region had doubled over the preceding 17 years. Max Bennett, an Oregon State University Extension agent in the Rogue Valley, says he's seen the situation getting worse.
The level of mortality of tree dieback this year is the most that I've seen in the 16 years that I've been down here.
Bennett took note of the weather data during the most recent drought in southern Oregon from 2013 to 2015.
In Medford, for that 36-month period, 26 of the 36 months had below average rainfall, and 31 of the 36 months had above average temperatures.
Bennett says this has historically been a cyclical phenomenon. As drought cycles have come and gone, conifer die-off has fluctuated with them. But recent research at the Los Alamos National Labs in New Mexico suggests that, as global warming increases, drought may be less of a factor than hotter temperatures. Plant ecologist Sean Michaelitz contributed to that research. He says high temperatures put trees under stress, not only by increasing demand for water, but by speeding up the tree's internal processes, such as photosynthesis and respiration.
The rate of chemical reactions increases exponentially with temperature, and if temperature becomes too high, these physical processes can basically crash and stop working.
While more frequent droughts are one likely result of climate change in the Northwest, the Los Alamos findings suggest that rising temperatures mean more tree death, even if there's plenty of rainfall. That's because warmer air pulls moisture out of trees and the soil. Los Alamos researcher Turin Dickman.
So whether or not precipitation regimes change as temperature increases with CO2, trees are going to be experiencing drier conditions.
Dickman and her colleagues project that unless trees adapt quickly to the changing climate, pine and fir-based forests in much of the West could see massive die-off by 2050. That would likely lead to structural changes in Northwest forests, with new species of plants replacing the conifers, meaning the forest landscapes our grandchildren grow up with could look very different from the ones we've enjoyed for generations. I'm Liam Moriarty, reporting.
This is KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information, and in the news today, authorities now say a man they describe as the main guy behind the explosions in New York City and New Jersey, that suspect is undergoing surgery after a shootout with police. Linden, New Jersey, Police Captain James Sarnicki says it's not often you find a high-profile suspect sleeping in a doorway.
My guess is he was probably on the run and running out of options.
Investigators say they found no evidence yet that the suspect was part of a broader terrorist cell. President Obama says terrorists are trying to incite fear.
We all have a role to play as citizens in making sure that we don't succumb to that fear. And there's no better example of that than the people of New York and New Jersey.
Meanwhile, in St. Cloud, Minnesota, the police chief there says there's nothing yet to suggest it was more than a lone attacker who stabbed 9 people at a shopping mall over the weekend. But federal investigators say they're looking at the attack as a potential act of terrorism after the Islamic State group claimed that the suspect had heeded its calls for attacks in countries that are part of a U.S.-led anti-Islamic State coalition. The governor, Mark Dayton, says Minnesotans are going to bounce back from this frightening attack.
I implore the citizens of St. Cloud and really citizens throughout Minnesota to rise above this tragic incident.
We will have the latest on both of these investigations later this afternoon here on KUOW's All Things Considered. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Bill Radke. You might use apps to help you keep track of your life. Maybe you have one for your exercise routine or your money or your schedule. But you also give those apps something in return, your data. One Clarkston, Washington woman used to take that for granted. She downloaded an app to track her pregnancy, and she happily handed over her name and her address and phone number to get it. Amy Pittman says it was worth it to her. She checked in and followed along as her pregnancy grew to the size of a lavender bud. Then, at about 8 weeks, she miscarried. She told KUOW's Jeannie Yandel about her experience and how big data handled her loss.
The day of the miscarriage, I was very pragmatic. It was just checking off a box of things that I needed to get done, you know, in order to kind of close that chapter. And so in the app, you have an option to report a loss or report a miscarriage. And so I selected it. And the app wiped my data. And that was the last time I opened it. And so I was pretty pragmatic for the first month. And I had a really good friend who'd had several miscarriages. And she gave me some good advice. And she said, whatever you feel that day, feel it. And don't try to justify it or change it, because that feeling will change tomorrow. And she was right. You know, a couple months down the line, I was sad and I was surprised because I had been so pragmatic at the beginning. And so as I was walking through it, I tried to just feel whatever the feeling was that I felt of the day.
Beyond having that circle of family, that close friend of yours who gave you that advice, did you talk to other people about what you were feeling, what you're going through about having had a miscarriage?
Not really. My mother and my mother-in-law both miscarried their first pregnancies. And so I talked to them and I talked to my husband, and I had, you know, two close friends outside of that that I was pretty raw with, and like giving them updates if I felt it was necessary. Like, you know, I remember a few times laying in bed at night with my husband and I just said, I'm sad today. I'm sad about the miscarriage. And then there were days that I wasn't sad. Now I'm crying.
Amy, I'll tell you, I miscarried when I was 8 weeks pregnant too. And it's a really strange thing how some days you feel like you're just good with it. And then it changes. It just changes. It's really weird.
Like the drop of the hat.
Yeah,
it is weird.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry for your loss as well.
Oh, well, thank you. It's really resonating what you're saying. But you had something kind of unusual happen that caused you to realize you didn't have a lot of control over who knew what you'd been through. What happened to you?
About 7 months after my miscarriage, I received a package of formula samples on my doorstep. There were four different types of formula samples, and there was all this literature about formula feeding, and it was centered perfectly on my doormat. And I was pretty close to my due date and struggling more than I had in the earlier days at that point. And I just remember staring at it and thinking, what in the world? And I picked it up and I brought it inside and I unpacked it and I repacked it and I put it aside and I just stared at it. And then I started laughing. And I mean, I wouldn't have anticipated necessarily that would have been my response. And my husband came home and I showed him, and he's kind of looking at me like, all right, how do we feel about this? And I said, babe, the internet thinks I'm still pregnant. And I started laughing. And then he started laughing, and it was a joke. I mean, it was hilarious to us. My pregnancy's messing with the internet. Like, my pregnancy's trolling the internet. It thinks that I'm pregnant, and it's going to keep sending me all this crap.
Why did that make you laugh so hard?
I'm not sure. I remember having this moment going, this could really piss me off, or this could really make me sad. And I laughed anyway. Like, I was very aware that I could have thought differently. But, you know, I think it made me laugh because the internet is everywhere. You know, we have internet on our TV, and I have internet access on my watch and on my phone and on our computers. And the internet tells me, you know, a month in advance to start looking for anniversary presents for my husband, and seems to know all of these things about our life. And I think we take it for granted that the internet is going, or that, you know, these various apps or websites know more about us than we want them to know. And yet it had missed this very big event in our lives. And I found that humorous.
Well, once the internet made this fairly significant mistake about your life and the fact that you weren't pregnant anymore. You wrote an essay about your miscarriage and the box of formula and the mistake the internet made, and you sent it to the New York Times. And you told our producer earlier that you did the writing because it was a kind of therapy to process what you'd been through and what happened, but it actually got published. So what kind of response did you get?
That's actually been incredibly interesting. I mean, first of all, there have been so many people who have reached out, you know, with virtual hugs and, you know, I'm sorry for your loss. And there's been such a great movement of support for women who have gone through miscarriages because I don't think it's talked about often. And then there's been this other really weird and unanticipated reaction, which is, you know, against big data and marketing, which I did not anticipate. But that has been probably the more interesting reaction to follow because everyone's up in arms about big data. And I'm now part of that conversation.
What kind of responses have you gotten about big data and privacy?
You know, people saying this is when big data goes wrong or be careful about what you say on the internet. There have been some responses that have suggested that I'm technophobic because I think that the internet is picking on me. Or there are other people who have called me an ally against, you know, the threat of big data and privacy. And I'm just like, sure, but really I just lost a baby and I was trying to figure out how to feel through it.
Well, is there any truth to what those responses have been, that you're now an ally against big data?
Maybe. I really, I have no idea. I think that there have been so many responses from women who have had the exact same thing happen, who have, I saw, you know, someone who lost a baby 9 years ago and she's still getting birthday cards sent from various companies for that baby. There were women who reached out to me to tell me that in the 80s before the internet, they were receiving coupons because their pharmacist sold their information because they got a prenatal vitamin and then they miscarried. And so there seems to be a hole where loss is not reported and it is harmful to some people. And my personal response was to laugh, but I understand that there's been a lot of damage done by just this, you know, wide net gathering without a lot of editing in the process.
What did you think when you started hearing those stories from other women who told you things like that? I'm still getting birthday cards 9 years later. I got coupons in the mail because my pharmacist sold information about me.
You know, my heart broke and I realized that, you know, my response was to laugh and I'm so grateful that that was my response. But, you know, for people who weren't able to find any humor in it, you know, they're getting yearly reminders of their loss. And having now read through the responses and watched kind of the conversation evolving, I do think that there should be a better way. It's not perfect the way it is. And this maybe should be something that is looked at. If the internet is smart enough to know that my anniversary is coming up and to suggest ideas, or if algorithms are able to do this, then there should also be the ability that people can opt out from that.
Amy, now that you've had your own experience with the internet getting something wrong and you've heard from so many other people who have had similar experiences, how do you think about sharing personal information with apps and the idea of big data, that the internet knows everything about us so it can sell stuff to us?
You know, it's interesting because I hadn't really thought that my behaviors had changed until a producer asked me, and I realized that I had stopped using my period tracker, and it had been about a month since I had stopped using it. And I wouldn't say that it's not directly related to wanting to keep my information private from big data and from marketers. I just, all of a sudden, I don't feel the need to document my life that way. I don't need a data point to tell me that, you know, I had a period or that, you know, my husband and I had sex. You know, I don't need that data verification anymore. And I don't know if that's a forever thing, but for now, I'm just going to kind of go with it. And maybe it will disconnect my life from apps a little bit. And not, again, not out of fear, but just out of the lack of, I just don't desire to do that anymore.
Amy Pittman lives in Clarkston, Washington, in eastern Washington, and she wrote about her miscarriage and her experience with big data for the Modern Love column in the New York Times. We're sharing a link to that column with you on Twitter right now, at KUOW. A major draw of Seattle is its natural beauty, except it didn't happen naturally. Crosscut writer Knute Berger says Seattle's like an aging Hollywood star, a star who's had some work done.
People come to Seattle, they think, oh, what a beautiful natural city, it's so environmental and all that. But when you actually look at the history of Seattle, we are a place that's manufactured for manufacturing. I mean, we were a city that the founders wanted to build a modern industrial city. The landscape was not conducive to that particularly, and so they set about a massive remaking of the landscape. And I think most people that come to Seattle, you know, they see the trees, they see the mountains, but they really don't know how Seattle itself was really mangled in so many ways.
Do Seattleites think of their city as natural, or do they think of the mountains and water around it as natural?
Well, I think they think both. I think they, you know, obviously the setting is dramatic and that kind of thing, but I don't think they realize that Lake Washington wasn't originally connected with Puget Sound. When we made that connection, built the ship canal and connect Lake Union, Lake Washington, and the ship canal, the lake dropped 9 feet, and a river that used to run out of the lake disappeared. People don't realize that the Duwamish River wasn't straight.
Right.
It used to come down as a meandering stake. The entire industrial area of the city, Sodo and the industrial district, was all like, you know, gorgeous tide flats and Duwamish Delta. It was this wild fowl and sea life rich place that was literally just filled in with dirt so we could build factories.
When you realize Seattle didn't have to be this way, you can wonder, how could we have done it differently? What about a do-over?
Yeah, well, that's something that's intrigued me for a while. So recently I was at Town Hall with David Williams, who wrote a book called Too High and Too Steep, which documents the plastic surgery that Seattle's received over the years. And somebody suggested at this thing that it would be neat to have like a 3D computer model that showed how the city changed over time. And you can find things a little similar to that online already. What I was proposing is I'd like to see a 3D model that you could then make alternative decisions. You could sort of say, well, what if we decided to build a city but not fill in those tide flats and have a gorgeous wetland there? Or one of the famous things Seattle did was it eliminated one of its hills.
In Belltown.
240-foot high mini mountain. I mean, it would be a mountain in many states. And, you know, it took us maybe 30 years to get that area flat. But that's why that huge expanse of flat area that is Belltown and the Denny Triangle and that whole area, that's why that exists. There was a hill there and it was washed away and dumped into Elliott Bay. And, you know, when you look back and you think, well, really, I mean, they had some practical reasons for wanting to get rid of Denny Hill, which was mainly they wanted to be able to go north-south faster, which, of course,
I still do.
We're still dealing with that, yes, with Bertha and the viaduct and all of that. But, you know, if you imagine that if we didn't get rid of Denny Hill, this would have been one of the most spectacular urban neighborhoods in Seattle with these fabulous views right adjacent to downtown. It might have developed much more quickly than it did because what happened was they flattened that area and nothing happened for like 50 years. Only now is some of the parking lots and whatnot out there being developed by Amazon. Would we have developed urbanized much more rapidly if we'd left that hill in place? Anyway, so my idea is that if you can look at the you know, the path's not taken. Look at the kind of what ifs. What if we had done things differently? What might that teach us about what we could do differently now and into the future? And also, are there projects that might suggest themselves from a restoration standpoint?
So what would you have done differently and why?
Well, as I mentioned, one thing is I think, you know, erasing Denny Hill was a mistake. And I think it's important to say there were very practical reasons for a lot of what was done, but a lot of it would not pass muster by today's environmental standards. In fact, virtually none of it would have. I mean, these things were really devastating to the environment.
But isn't that a luxury to have our environmental standards now when the people who went before us already did all the work of making the locks and the canal and the waterfront? So now we can tisk tisk.
Well, they did a lot of great things, but they also did a lot of things that we're still paying through the nose for. I mean, cleaning up the Duwamish is one of those things. So what it is like an exercise in, you know, what alternatives might have turned out like. And it forces you to think, too, about the economic and socioeconomic aspects. So the things that intrigue me, one is, could we in some way do more to restore those wetlands? We're already working on cleaning up the Duwamish, but is there a way, and this might be over the next 100 years, you know, is there a way if port facilities, for example, get consolidated and moved to Tacoma, you know, could we have a shot at recreating the original Duwamish? That would be one thing.
So the Duwamish isn't straightened for industrial use, no Boeing here, and so my dad doesn't come to work here, so
that's right. Hey, that's
so Radke.
But you could, in this game, you know, you could try alternative things. In other words, would there have been a way that you could have made those wetlands compatible yet still had a Boeing? And where maybe you would have located it at a different location. Those are the kinds of games that you could play with this thing. I also think there's a sociological kind of a social equity piece of this, too. When the settlers came here originally, Chief Seattle envisioned a kind of blended multicultural society. He wanted the Native Americans and whites to work together and come together. He acted almost like a real estate agent, urging whites to come to Seattle, to settle, to intermarry. And so one scenario you could play, well, what if the Europeans had bought into Chief Seattle's idea of a society? How would Seattle look different if we had been able to accomplish some of that blended culture, or had incorporated the indigenous ideas and indigenous management of the land and whatnot with our urban concepts, as opposed to just paving stuff over? And that, to me, also seems like a very worthy exercise.
Any of the plastic surgery that you would keep if you could?
Oh, that's a good question. It's hard to imagine breaking that ship canal. The ship canal's, 100 years old next year. So it's hard to imagine breaking that link between Lake Washington, Lake Union, and Puget Sound. So I think that would be a very difficult one to redo. And I think that had a lot of practical value.
Is there any of this musing, Knut, that can help us now and in the future in Seattle?
Well, I think so. I mean, we're already engaged in certain do-overs. Tearing down the viaduct, there's a do-over. Restoring the Elwha River, taking the dams down, that's an interesting do-over. The Nisqually Delta down by Olympia, that's being restored and recreated. There may be other projects on even on a small scale or even a grander scale that could be incorporated into development in the future. And the other thing is, there's this interesting sort of war in Seattle over time between these two competing visions of the city. One I call the R.H. Thompson vision. He was the Seattle chief engineer. He was in charge of the regrade. He was a guy, if something was in the way, you plowed through it, you built a road, you know. And the other competing vision was the Olmsted vision, the guys who designed the parks, the boulevards. And if you look at those two things, we sort of needed them both. But you have the sort of practical industrial city and the natural city. I think there's a way those two things could blend better. I think there's a way in which some of the Olmsted way of thinking, which is adapting to the landscape, having roads that follow the contours, ways of shaping the city that bring nature into the city, they're both shaping. It's not like you're keeping the city completely natural. But I think we sort of leaned way too far over on the R.H. Thompson side of the equation.
Dominate nature.
That's right. And not enough on the more integrative side. I think we're often... we give too much rein to the side which is the shortest distance between two points, trying to put a grid on Seattle. There's a reason you can't get anywhere. We built the city in a place that makes it impossible to get anywhere. The glaciers moved south and then retreated north, creating ribbons of hills and valleys that run north and south. What do you do if you want to go east and west? You're screwed. You know, anybody that drives in the city knows that.
Could we have put the city in a different place if we'd have been able to see the
future?
That's
an interesting thing. You might find that that Seattle, if we look, you know, by sort of in current environmental thinking, you could argue, well, we might not have built a city here at all. Or we might have laid it out very differently. The center of the city might be in a different location. And those are the kinds of things that you can play with. And I think they're the kinds of things that just free people's thinking so that we're not so locked into, well, how do we solve the Mercer mess? Maybe there's a more creative way to look at the whole fabric. And maybe that will tell us something about the way we could shape things in the future.
Crosscut writer, the Mossback columnist, Knut Berger there. We're tweeting out a link to his story now. What piece of Seattle's plastic surgery would you undo? We'd like to know. We'll find out when you write us at record@kuow.org and follow us on Twitter @KUOW. Local sports news is not good for the Seahawks. They managed 3 points yesterday against the unimpressive Los Angeles Rams. So the Seahawks are 1-1 now. The Mariners are 2 games behind in the wild card race. They play tonight in Seattle against the Blue Jays. Yesterday, the Seattle Storm beat Chicago, and they're 2 games below 500. And now you're caught up. It's KUOW's The Record. Talking baseball with Todd Bishop. We just got to work around this Hernandez guy.
Yeah,
we might have a chance.
The dog of the lineup there, yeah.
Todd Bishop here to tell us why Bill Gates is in Vancouver, BC this week promoting that city as a hub of tech innovation. Todd, and he's got Microsoft CEO along with him. What's going on?
That's right. It's a rare appearance tomorrow for Bill Gates, the co-founder of Microsoft, and Satya Nadella, the CEO, at a conference called the Cascadia Innovation Corridor Conference. The whole idea. Did you know that you lived in the Cascadia Innovation Corridor, Bill?
I knew about the Cascadia. I was aware of the corridor. I didn't realize that innovation linked us and Vancouver. And I want to know how that works exactly.
So the idea of leaders in Washington State and British Columbia is to essentially create a hub out of these two cities and these two different countries, which is no small obstacle. So they are having this conference headlined by Bill Gates and Satya Nadella, but also by the British Columbia Premier and by Jay Inslee, the Washington State Governor. And the idea is to figure out how these two areas can become one in terms of technology and potentially rival Silicon Valley as a magnet for companies, for talent, and really make these two areas rise up together.
Okay, a few questions then. First of all, how could Seattle, you said it yourself, we're in different countries. Our laws are different. Our tax receipts go to two different governments. How can we be one hub of innovation or anything?
One of the ways is by playing to the complementary strengths. For example, Vancouver can bring in, for example, Microsoft has an office in Vancouver, and there they can employ people that they could not employ here because of restrictions and limits on H-1B visas for skilled workers coming in. So Microsoft has established a large presence in Vancouver. Amazon has done the same thing, in part because of immigration laws. So that is an advantage for the Seattle region, frankly, that we're only 3 hours away from this place where you can have much more liberal immigration policies.
Well, why does it matter that we're 3 hours away? I mean, if you care about a hub, I can imagine Silicon Valley being a hub, but, you know, 3 hours is 3 hours. Where's the big advantage?
Have you ever tried to get from downtown San Francisco to San Jose?
No, I'll give you that. I have not.
It can very much rival that time, if okay. not more. But then again, crossing the border can be difficult as well.
Yeah,
I think the general idea here is to eliminate some of those hurdles. For example, they're talking about ways to make transportation between Seattle and Vancouver, BC, faster. One of the ideas is to have high-speed rail. Separately this morning, Madrona Venture Group came out with a new study talking about a way to create dedicated self-driving vehicle lanes on I-5 between Seattle and Vancouver as another potential solution for this.
I saw that. And by the way, they were saying that would be relatively cheaper than building rail.
Yes.
Right? We could give everybody a Tesla for that much money that we'd spend on rail.
That's right. Something on the order of $30 billion to make high-speed rail doable. And yes, boy, Elon Musk would love that.
I imagine. Self-driving car in the self-driving lane. They just zip up and down. And so you don't have to drive. Think how innovative you could be in your car and if you don't have to stare at the wheel, right?
That's right. Bottom line, innovation regions and economies are created by a critical mass. And if Seattle and Vancouver together can create that critical mass of investors, employees, companies, there is a better chance for each city and each region to become part of this Uber region that essentially creates a much more competitive climate. You had the company called Slack. I'm sure many folks out there are familiar with
this. We use Slack
this.
Here, our workers at KUOW.
Runaway hit success collaboration tool. That actually got started in Vancouver, BC, and the founder, Stuart Butterfield, they still have some presence there, but he moved the headquarters to Silicon Valley because really, if you're going to create that kind of a world-changing company, the conventional wisdom right now is you have to be in Silicon Valley for the employees, the engineers, and the investors. And this conference this week is Seattle and Vancouver saying, hey, let's see if we can do something about that.
But the Seattle area couldn't hoover up some of that work? Just we couldn't grow that hub in Western Washington? You know, we've got Snohomish County here and lots of land.
You know, absolutely. I think that Seattle itself has a lot of work to do. But there is a strong tech community in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
So why ignore it? You've got strong.
Because they're going to take our jobs. They took our film industry jobs. Now you're going to give away. I don't know. You know more about this than I do.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Maybe that's going to be the next campaign issue at the national level with some of our presidential candidates. I don't know.
Right.
Although I think the wall is going on the southern border, not the northern border.
So I've heard.
Yes. But there is a lot of strong companies up there. Hootsuite. I don't know if you're familiar with that one.
I don't know Hootsuite.
It's a wonderful social media dashboard, and many, many people use it. It's based up in Canada, in Vancouver. And so there is the opportunity to basically bring these two regions together and make them stronger.
You mentioned immigration. Bill Gates has been banging on that for a while. How come the United States doesn't allow more H-1B visa
workers?
Oh,
boy. That is a congressional issue. Microsoft has been trying to get that loosened for many years. The argument is actually a valid one. The contention is that those workers coming in are taking jobs that would have otherwise gone to people trained here. And then the counterargument is, well, the types of engineers we need are not coming out of schools here in the volume that we need. And so there's a lot of argument back and forth there.
Okay. Vancouver, BC and Seattle, WA may be working together. This conference is called the Emerging Cascadia Corridor Conference, today and tomorrow. So it's Bill Gates and Satya Nadella and many others, of course, including, as you said, the governor of Washington and the premier of British Columbia. Those are some heavy hitters.
They've got the right people in the room. We'll see what happens.
You've been listening to Todd Bishop, who is the editor and co-founder at the tech news site GeekWire. Thanks, Todd.
Thank you, Bill.
If Donald Trump became president, what would he actually do? A New Yorker writer has made his best estimate. We're going to talk with that writer this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. Also on the show today, my boyhood crush, Charmian Carr, has passed away. She played Liesl von Trapp in the movie version of The Sound of Music. Yeah, look at Todd. He looks stricken.
I'm completely crushed.
16 going on 17. Yes, she sang that with Rolf in the gazebo, but let's not overlook the sweeter version she did with Maria on the couch. Anyway, I've said too much, Todd, but I was a fan.
Oh, man, Sound of Music. Just watched it a few months ago.
Yeah.
Can't get enough of it.
It's a perennial, and so are the tears. We're going to remember Charmian Carr today and All Things Considered. You know who auditioned for her part, among other people?
No.
Mia Farrow.
Whoa.
Could have been Liesl. So much more to say, too. Join us later this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered.
Hey, this is Jad Abumrad from Radiolab. So the public radio funding model is unique. It's driven by you, the listeners. And listeners have told KUOW that their membership drives are too long, and they have heard you. They have. Your gift right now can help KUOW cancel, as in nix, the first day of the upcoming fall drive. It's less drive and more destination, and you are in the driver's seat. Mail in your gift or pledge online today at KUOW.org, and thanks.